This is the Live Feed. It's your connection to live music and entertainment in Winona. Support for this program is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Now, here's Terry Tenseth with the Live Feed.
On Saturday, November 19th, it was time for comedy in Winona. The feature comedian writes for Rooftop Comedy, has performed for the troops overseas, and has even penned his own book, entitled I Was a White Knight, Once, an Uncommon Memoir. On this edition of the Live Feed, we get to learn a little bit about the mind of this comedian and hear part of his performance from the Big Boobs Comedy Show. Just a little disclaimer before we start, tonight's Live Feed does contain adult themes and topics. You're listening to the Live Feed, and I have comedian and now author Nathan Timmel with me. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So you drove all the way from Iowa, 4 hours away.
Iowa City, yes.
Awesome. And you've done Minnesota before a lot? Or
plenty of times. Okay. Most often and most frequently over in Rochester, the club called Goonies.
Oh, yeah. 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 A lot of people go to Goonies, it turns out. So
it's a lovely little club.
Well, first things first, I had read, because I was cyber-stalking you, that for you, the comedy thing kind of started when you were 6 years old and bought a George Carlin album, or was it your grandmother?
It was my grandmother. I conned her into buying. I didn't know who George Carlin was. I'm not going to, you know, say it, but I was walking through a store, and that was back when record albums existed. This is the 1970s we're talking, so
right.
it was a big cover, big vinyl 12-inch cover, and it had a picture of a man picking his nose on it.
Awesome.
And when you're 6 years old, it's like, yay, nose picking, that's funny, I want that. And they didn't have explicit lyrics stickers back then either, so I point, my grandmother says, okay, and buys it, and the next thing I know, I can say the seven dirty words to all my friends at 6 years old. You know, what, my second grade maybe? I'm just running around, and I got those memorized. It was great. I won't repeat them right now, but
no.
That was my introduction to comedy right there.
And was your mom pretty mad at your grandma for that?
No, I don't think she really knew her. It wasn't really on her radar. And my dad was fine with it, I'm not sure if you want to call him a good parent or a bad parent,
right?
Because he would do things like not care about George Carlin. When I was 5 years old, he kept me up late because there was a program premiering, and he's like, you have to see this. And I'm watching these people in bee suits going, this is great. It was Saturday Night Live. So at five, I probably should have been in bed by 11:30 p.m., 10:30, whatever time zone. But yeah, I was up watching Saturday Night Live, so
nice.
He was an accidental influence on my career.
When did you realize you actually were funny?
I don't know that I've ever realized that. That's up to every individual audience. I just say what interests me, and hopefully people laugh at it. I have no ego about it going, yay, I'm funny, or people should listen to me.
You're in about year 15 or 16 of doing comedy now, right?
About 13, I think.
13? Okay.
Yeah, somewhere around there.
So what made you decide to go ahead and try comedy?
Lack of anything else to do with my life.
Really?
Yeah. I got out of college. I had a degree in English, which makes me unemployable. I could teach, I suppose, if I wanted to get a teaching certificate. I was in a college band that broke up, and I was sitting around going, wow, I'm really not doing anything with my life other than tending bar. This is not, you know, a career path. So somehow I heard of an open microphone in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where I was living, and went down there, stood on stage, told some jokes, said, yay, I'm hooked, just like heroin or crack, something like that, and been doing it ever since.
Do you ever have a slew of bad nights, or how do you handle that?
A slew, not really. If you want to go back to the beginning, everybody says the first time they got on stage, oh, it was horrible, I was bad, I was rotten. First time I got on stage, I did really well. And I'm like, yay, I can do this, I'm a great comic. And then, like, the next 3, 4, 5 times in a row, I failed. And I'm like, wait a second, that first time I was really good, what happened? Why can't it every night be like that first night? But then you just sort of fall into a rhythm. You can still have a one-off show. I haven't had a series of bad shows, knock on wood, in a while. But, you know, you have a one-off where, for whatever reason, the stars don't align. The audience isn't feeling it. You're selling it half-assed. I'm selling it half-assed. You know, just that whatever the reason is, you can't have a bad show at any time.
Do you ever have embarrassing moments, or do you just kind of let that roll off your back? And
I let it roll off my back. I'm not easily embarrassed in life, much less on stage. So I have very little shame. So anything that might go wrong, well, that went wrong. And that's about my reaction is, wow, that sucked. I wish that hadn't happened. And you move on.
I would guess you would need to, really, to kind of be able to keep doing it night after night. You can't let that stuff kind of stick in your head and live rent free in there.
It does anyway. It just, whether or not you let it bother you. I mean, I can go back in 10 years and if I wanted to sit down and write out, okay, this show was bad, this show was bad, this, but I can't do that with the ones where, you know, oh, it was applause and, you know, they carried me around on chairs like it was a Jewish wedding afterwards. Yay, everybody loved me. Can't remember those, but if, you know, I can remember the bad shows, or, and I can remember why they were bad.
Okay. So you can learn from that if there's something.
I don't know if you can learn from it, but failure sticks with you, or yeah, sticks with me. I mean, like, I'll give you a one-off example. The club doesn't exist anymore. It was outside of Chicago in Aurora. It was in a steakhouse. It was inside a restaurant that was portioned off or partitioned, however, whichever word you want to use. So anyway, it was, well, I don't want to go into too detail. Long story short, it was, comedy was not the focus. Oh. So I remember standing on stage and people are distracted and they're talking because they're eating and they're like, oh, why is this guy talking to us? So where this started, what you said is you can learn from it. I suppose the lesson you could learn is don't take gigs that are in restaurants.
Right.
But other than that, you know, you can't really, wow, what could I do to change myself to make myself more appealing to the restaurant growing crowd? You know, that you're not going to do that, hopefully.
I've heard of other incidences where, like, a place has tried comedy for the first time and then it just falls flat because everybody's there to either watch sports,
right,
or do something else. And it's just kind of, it never really clicks.
Someone did that when I was starting out in Milwaukee. They put, this is fun. I haven't thought of this in years. But a friend who's actually not with us anymore, not that that means anything, he put together a show at a NASCAR bar in Milwaukee.
Oh, wow.
And this friend of mine happened to be black. And NASCAR and black doesn't really go well together.
Right.
So as he was trying to open the show, there were people that were grumbling and irritated. And why is it? And I actively heard racial slurs being used. They weren't tossed his way, but they thought because I was white and sitting near them that they could just drop the bombs. And I'm like, hey, I think I want to leave. I don't think I like you people. This is not my... my idea of fun, yeah.
Now, you actually have traveled overseas quite a bit.
Yep.
What got you involved in going to do comedy shows for the troops?
It was an accident, just like most things that happen in life. I lived in Los Angeles for a period of years, 6 years maybe, I don't know, and was on stage doing what I do, telling jokes. I walked off stage, and a guy walked up to me and said, hey, have you ever thought of performing for the troops? And at that point, I had not, so I said, no, what? Tell me about it. He said, well, here's a card with an email address on it. I'm going to write this down for you. It wasn't a business card. He handwrote an email address, said, email this person and drop my name. Then he gave me his name. So I did, and the person said, oh, all right, well, let's just fire you off. Let's send you overseas. I'm like, wow, that was easy.
Quick.
Found out months later that the person that approached me was the booking agent's brother.
Oh.
And did not like that information getting out. Said, don't tell anybody I'm giving you this. I just sort of, he did it, you know, he didn't want every comic in Los Angeles hitting him up for, hey, I want to go overseas. So he would just sort of casually, you know, here, use my name, but don't tell anybody except the booker that, and yeah, like I said, it was the booker's brother. So once I did that tour and it went well, then for a while it just sort of steamrolled. I haven't been over in a couple of years because the weird thing about the military is it's a big, ugly animal. It's governmental, which means there's a lot of red tape, and every single booking agent I have gone over with has either lost contracts or had them, Not by any wrongdoing on their part, just by other bookers come in and bid, and it's the nature of the beast. It's, you meet someone, you go overseas, and the next year it's like, someone stole my contract. You have to wait till next year. So then you make a new contact, and then they lose, and then you go back to the original. Like, I've gone over for the same person 3 times over the period of 10 years because they keep gaining and losing different contracts. Just, that's the way it is. So I'd love to go more regularly, but it's a big, ugly beast, the red tape you have to fight when you're working with government.
What's the reaction from the troops when you're over there performing?
Varies. It can be anywhere. Military can, it can be very appreciative, loving, giving, laughter, release, thank God you're here, just something distractionary to take our mind off it. And on the other end of the spectrum, it can be, they can sit there, I don't want to say stoically, but maybe sort of like a wry smile, like, yeah, that was good, I liked that. Oh, that was funny. Because they're military, which means they're trained every day to maintain a control over their emotion. They're I don't want to say beaten down, but, you know, you have the drill sergeant then, you know, toughen up, maggot, you're not going to, are you laughing at me? So after the show, when they've sat there and been, you know, like I said, hey, that was funny, I liked that one. That was nice. If I was a person that laughed, I would have laughed at that. So after a show like that, you'll be on stage going, wow, they didn't like me. But they'll all come up to you and go, that was so funny. That was the best time. And you're like, oh, all right. Well, everybody reacts in their own way.
So it's kind of hard to feel the energy then.
Yeah. But you don't take it personally because right. you don't know what's going through their mind at all. You can't project onto them. I mean, they may have been in the field for 18 hours. They may be on their final month and they just want to go home and they're distracted. But like I said, when they come up to you afterwards and say that they really appreciated it, that's all that matters. It's not whether or not they're laughing and going, yay, this is the best time of our life. All you're doing is you're over there to provide them for a moment's distraction from the fact that tomorrow they're going to wake up and still be in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Right. No, you've done that like 8 times now.
Right? I've been to various countries. Yeah, I've been to Iraq 3 times. Only Afghanistan once, but it was for an entire month. I've been to Japan, Korea, Kuwait, Kyrgyzstan, Germany. I start to forget.
What place had the biggest influence on you out of those different travels?
I don't know that any place had an influence on me. They all do in their own way. The one thing that I would say, and I don't try and preach, I don't try and come off as, I just keep it quiet to myself, but when I see someone in a restaurant yelling at the waiter or in a grocery store going, oh, these lines are so long, anybody b***ing or complaining about anything I find trivial, it just sort of sets a flare off in my mind going, there are some people over in Afghanistan dealing with worse things right now. I think it's a little perspective barometer for me, I guess. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say that it made me a completely humble person, but it's a check, a stopgap, a sort of, you know, where you just
perspective change.
Yeah,
perspective.
Yeah, like I said, in those moments, when I've been in a restaurant and the waitress is, oh my God, I'm so busy. There was an instance a couple of weeks ago where my wife and I and my mom and my fake dad were in a restaurant, and 20 minutes went by and she came and said, I just realized that somehow your order did not go through. And we're like, that's fine, you know, whatever. And other people would react with that. Oh my God, we've got tickets to the play and this is the worst night of our life and it's our anniversary and you ruined it. Really? 20 minutes waiting for food is ruining your whole life. Maybe you should put a gun in your mouth and kill yourself if that's the worst thing that ever happens to you, is that you waited 20 minutes for food.
Right.
I mean, you know, the waitress was nice. She was apologetic. You don't eat. They're just trivial things.
Right.
So as you said, perspective, an idea of what is important and what is not.
Tell me about your process for writing for your different shows. Like, how often does that change? Where do you go to? I mean, what's your process like?
Comedic writing? Mm-hmm. I don't have a process anymore. I know comics, and there's no right way or wrong way. It's per the individual. I know comics that sit down with a piece of paper and say, I need to write for an hour. I'm on the radio right now. I need to write a joke about being on the radio because there's something that can be funny about that. Whereas I am more situational. I will be driving for 4 hours at a stretch and something will pop into my head and I'll just drive and zone and think about it. And then I'll bring it to the stage and I'll work it out in front of an audience. And I'll tell the joke repeatedly in front of different audiences until it gets to the point I think it's working. Or if I never get to that point, I'll probably let it go. But I don't have a creative process where maybe that is your answer. Maybe right. That's my creative process, is thinking of an idea or having an experience in my life and wanting to talk about it or express my opinion and then working it out on stage. Whereas others will stand in front of their mirror and get the gesture down and word the joke specifically. Here is where word A goes. This is where the word the go, you know, and they work it out and then they stand in front of the audience and say the words verbatim as they have written them.
Right. So you don't necessarily keep a notepad, and when you think of something, you write it down.
I might have that, but if I don't start working on it right away, I will see the sketch a little while later and go, blue folder pencil. What was I going to do with that? Right. There was something there that was supposed to be funny. Headphones. Why did I write down? But in the moment, I've got something going on in my head that's going, blue folder pencil, headphones. Oh, wait, if I say that and then speak, there's something going on that makes me write it down. I better not forget this. What I've come to do a lot more with the advent of better technology is with smartphones. I keep that and I'll hopefully speak several words into the recorder on the cell phone that I can listen back to later and go, oh, that was brilliant. I need to work on that. Or go, wow, I was really, really tired because that's crap. You know, where you're just like in that exhausted phase and everything's funnier. Oh, that's genius. But no, it's not.
So you kind of changed situationally almost too, your routine, it sounds like.
Well, when I'm on stage, I have all the bits in my head. I can talk about my wife traveling overseas, the dog, whatever. But what happens with each individual audience is it depends on the mood I'm in. Again, no right way or wrong way to do this. I know comics that get up and do jokes A through Z for their set every night, and that's how they do it. I get up, and if I were to do the same set every night in that order, I would grow bored with it, and I'd be dragging ass on stage, right, and the audience probably wouldn't be responding. So I have to, it depends on when I'm walking up to the stage, what's in my mind? What do I feel like talking about? Do I feel like doing this joke right now and then seeing where the set goes, or do I feel like going, you know, all the jokes are written. It's just the order they come out of me and is what changes, because that's what keeps it amusing to me, is trying to find connections and segues during the set.
Now, you said you had a wife, you have two cats and one dog, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
What's it like with a wife knowing that you do comedy? Is she a comedian? Does she have a good sense of humor about it? Do you have to have discussions about what goes into the routine if you write about her?
No.
She's pretty chill.
She's only asked me to pull a joke once because it involved our sex life and her grandparents were going to be in the audience.
Oh, well, yeah.
So that's it. Every other time she's been fine. What would she really care that I'm on stage in Winona, Minnesota, talking mm-hmm. about her? I mean, she's back in Iowa City. I don't think I would have married someone that would be so paranoid as to be sitting in Iowa City going, right now he's talking about me. I know he's talking about me. He shouldn't be talking about me or anything angrily. But, you know, she's just, whatever, you know, do your little thing as long as I don't have to hear about it. But then again, December 3rd, I'm doing a charity show in Iowa City that she'll be at.
Okay.
And it depends on whether, depending on her mood, she will or will not ask me to pull that joke again because her boss is there. But I think I did it a couple of years ago. Either way, the only time she's ever been touchy is when her grandparents, and I respected that. I'm like, fine, I will let it go for the sake of your grandparents who don't want to picture their granddaughter having sex.
Probably a good thing.
I would think so, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have an English degree.
Yes.
Is that from Iowa?
It's from the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee.
Oh, that's
motto.
Right.
Yeah, their motto is, we're like high school with tuition.
Awesome.
I think. At least that's what it was when I was there, and I've been told they bettered themselves, but, you know, I don't know.
Well, you write for Rooftop Comedy still?
Yeah, on occasion. I interview for them. Mm-hmm.
What's it like interviewing other comedians with yourself being a comedian?
How many people are going to hear this? How honest can I, do I have to
it's
be, or should I
you.
Lie? Should I? It, honestly, it depends on the comedian. I will tell you a good interview, and then I will not give you the name of a bad interview.
Okay.
Hal Sparks is a familiar name. He's sort of a bigger celebrity, or not. He's not huge, but he was a fantastic person. We didn't really interview. We did kind of what you and I are doing, just had a conversation. And I thought it was a fantastic conversation. And when I wrote it up, it seemed really nice, and the guys at Rooftop were happy. And I just really enjoyed it. And what I'll do in a situation like that is, if the person is throwing in things that don't really make sense because I've, you know, what Sarah Palin would call a gotcha question, if they just have a brain fart, I'll clean it up. Now, I talked to a comic who I won't name, who isn't even really a celebrity, so it doesn't matter, but was all over the place, incoherent, giving me sloppy answers and didn't seem to care. So I wrote it up verbatim and sent it in, and
oh,
they printed
wow.
it. And it's like, you know, if he wanted to say, oh, this makes me look bad, I'll just play back the recording and say, well, here you are. This is you. I didn't feel like fixing anything. I did not feel like helping brother out, a fellow comedian in a pinch. It was just sort of like, well, you're kind of irritating, so I'm going to let the world see you for who you are. And that wasn't a bad thing. It wasn't like he was saying racist things. It was just all over and and I would throw pauses in there and
wow.
And okay. there was 1 second where he contradicted himself. I don't remember what it was, but he literally said, well, what I'm trying to say is, it's not that I don't care about this stuff. I really do care, because blue folders and pencils, I'm just obviously, mm-hmm. they're really important to me. But I guess overall, I don't care about blue folders and pencils. I mean, he literally contradicted himself within a span of 10 seconds. So I just threw it in the interview. Whereas with Hal Sparks, who didn't do that, I would have probably cleaned it up a little, just taken out some of the pauses, or, you know, I create a flow to the interview. Sometimes I'll ask question number 1 and question number 10 will relate to question number 1. So when I write it up, I'll put the two of them together, even though that's the way it didn't happen in the conversation.
Gotcha. Talk to me a little bit about the process for your book and what made you decide to actually go ahead and write a book.
I'm going to go back. I don't know if this is a fallback answer, but I'm going to say the same thing I did with the military. I'm going to say it was accidental. I have always written my entire life. I've always just written stories, and usually nonfiction, because I'm not creative or clever enough to come up with fiction stories. When I was in college in Boston, before I went to Milwaukee, I went to a music school in Boston, and donated sperm for a period of time.
Hey, why not?
Yeah, to make some money. And the reason I'm telling you this is I thought that was an interesting story, so I wrote it up. I would this is back in the day before computers were household for the most part, so I typed it up on my brother typewriter, electronic typewriter, and then I went to a Xerox place, maybe a Kinko's if they existed back then, printed up copies and would hard mail them to friends who would then, you know, because this is before email again, so people would respond back and be like, wow, that was really funny. So I would always write stories. I would always, if something is like people do their annual Christmas letter, I would like two or three times a year come up with the this is the insane crap that's gone on in my life. So with the advent of Al Gore's internet and the popularity of what was MySpace a few years ago and now Facebook and blogging, all the kids blog because everybody thinks their thoughts are important, and I'm no different. So I would blog, and I started blogging about my life and going back in time to childhood and every story I really liked. And you ask about the process of a book. All I did was take a chunk of those blogs, expand them, turn them into a linear format. So it goes childhood to adulthood. And there you go. Suddenly I had a book and I didn't even realize it.
Did you read it after it was published?
Not since it's been published, because it just angers me too much. I will look at it and go, oh, I could have done that sentence better.
Oh, yeah.
Or I mean, during the editing process, I read it so many times that you want to throw up at one point. And so I have on occasion picked it up and read through a page or two, and there'll be a sentence where I just go, oh, I could have tweaked that one. So I try to just let it go, because if I'm going to look at it, I'm going to want to fix it, and it's already out there. So
you kind of feel like you could never be finished with it, do you think?
Probably not. And right. You just sort of, I don't want to call it striving for perfection, because there is no such thing, and I'm not anal retentive that way. To me, it's more the creative process. I like that. I like the idea of playing with word salad. So when I have them, that's why I love word processors and, you know, laptops, personal computers. You can just sit and, you know, jumble everything up and come up with different formats and different ways of saying what you want to say. And so that's what was fun to me. It's not a matter of, oh, this sentence has to be perfect. It's do I like it this way or this way? It's just more fun. And so that's what I see when I look at it today.
Would you want to write another book, do you think?
Oh, yeah. I've got in my brain, I've got two ideas right now. I've got in my head a series of nonfiction essays, and then the one after that would be back to my life, picking up where this one leaves off. This one leaves off with me asking my current wife to marry me. And so now we've had interesting times at the wedding, struggling with infertility and going through a year of infertility treatment and ongoing. And so those create interesting stories. So this one would probably be, I have no timeline on it, because the first book would be 40 years of my life, and I wouldn't want the next book to be, hey, here's age 40 to 45. Yay. I mean, it might be a little thin.
Right.
So I've got to get a little more life experience under my belt before I keep going.
I'm glad that you said that you actually like the process better than the end product, basically, is what you're saying, because it shows that you really, really do take your time with that, and that means a lot.
It took me 4 years to spit this one out, from saying, hey, I could turn this into a book, to, wow, I've got a book. It was 4 years of noodling, needling, and going, okay, where are the gaps? I've got age 1 to 5 down. Ooh, I'm missing, you know, age 10. What happened in my life in age 10? So then I would have to ask my mom, ask my dad, reconcile their stories with one another, come up with my own memories and say, okay, this is what I think, and then get it all out. So it's not like I just knocked it out. I didn't just like, yay, here's a book.
So that English degree has really come in handy, actually, for you.
Probably, hopefully.
And the comedy as well, too.
I don't know about with the comedy, maybe. The English degree was interesting because I took several writing courses, and I can only remember two of them. And I remember the one that I really, really hated, and I remember the one I really, really enjoyed. So the one I hated just happened to be with a fresh out of college quote professor, someone very young, and was very, you need to write this way. This is how you write. You cannot write in any other format than this way. And I thought it was very stifling, and you can't tell me how to write. It's writing. It's artistic. You do it however you want. And then several years later, when I got into an upper level course, that's what the professor was saying is, be free, write, yeah, you know, have fun. And someone turned in a paper that had no punctuation, and it was messy. and I didn't really enjoy it, but I enjoyed the idea of someone saying no punctuation. So, I mean, it was, and the professor did too. I said, maybe not the best story, but I really like that you tried something different. And that's what I liked was the, I don't, the encouragement, the idea of artistic freedom.
Is that what drew you actually to writing in the first place, or pursuing the English major? Was the English degree was the freedom of expression?
Possibly, but I think I went in more with a lean towards English literature. I remember going in and not liking English in high school because I didn't appreciate the teachers. But then when I took a couple English courses in college, requisite English courses, just to get them out of the way, I discovered I liked them. And I'm like, hey, what's this thing called Hamlet? Shakespeare? I thought I hated him. He's old and boring and stuffy. And the more I read it, the more I liked it. And then I got exposed to other stuff. And the next thing you know, I declared English Lit as a major.
What do you recommend to anybody looking to do comedy?
Absolutely nothing. I read an interview with Doug Stanhope, who said that when people ask him, he's a comic and widely respected, and they said when they ask him, he gives that answer and give no recommendations, because he was told once that if you ever do recommend something, you're just trying to get them to sound like you, and people have to sound like themselves. There's no rules for this. You can tell someone that it's all about getting on stage and stage time, stage time, stage time. You have to get on stage. Well, there can be a natural that just gets on stage for the first time and does it great. You can tell people to talk about themselves, but what if they don't want to? What if they want to create a character and do that character on stage? You can tell people you have to write about yourself and be honest. Well, what if they don't? What if they want to write about the absurd? So I have no advice for anyone other than to, if you're interested in comedy, go for it. That's it. Look into it, and then you'll figure it out from there.
Tell me where people can find your book, find out more information about you.
You can go to my website. It's just my name, NathanTimmel.com. And from there, I have links to everything. I have links to Amazon, the Barnes & Noble Nook. It's on every e-reader. It's on iBooks, the Sony Reader, Kindle, and Nook. So you can go to any of those, and or it's available paperback through Amazon. But if you go to NathanTimmel.com, I have all the links and pretty icons right there where you just click, oh, Amazon paperback. Oh, Amazon Kindle. So it's just sort of one stop. You don't have to go to Amazon and then do a search for me, and then just go to my website, and I've got it all taken care of.
Easy peasy. Lemon yep. Squeezy. And there's also a fun video of you getting attacked by a military police dog on there, too.
Yeah. So. Again, you talk about disappointments in life and how they don't stick with you. They were really, that one, it sticks with me a little bit because they were hesitant, and I could tell right away. You see the video, and it latches onto my arm, and I start swinging it around like I'm just having fun, and they're like, don't swing the dog around. I'm like, well, give me a dog that's big so that it doesn't, you know, they didn't want me to get hurt. They were worried, so they sent me the baby dog. It's a German Shepherd, I think, or I mean, it looks big, but they didn't give me the one I wanted, which was the, oh my God, it's taking me down and pulling my, I wanted to have fun with it. I really wanted to be attacked, and they didn't let me. So
I noticed you got a little bit of a running head start a couple times.
Well, they told me, yeah. They said, do you want to get a running head start and have it take you down? I'm like, absolutely I do. And then it couldn't take me down. And I'm like, I thought it was going to be a big, like vicious dog. I wanted to have it latch onto me, and it wasn't.
Oh, wow.
It's not a poodle, but it just was, you know.
It was an experience.
It was a fun experience. It makes for better visual than it does memory. Memory is all. I wish they could have had the bigger dog and gotten it on me, but.
Well, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Up next, we hear a portion of Nathan Timmel's performance from the Big Boobs Comedy Show, which took place Saturday, November 19th in downtown Winona. You're listening to The Live Feed.
All right, you guys, you're in luck tonight. Give it up, you guys, for Nathan Timmel.
How about for Sue and for Lindsay and for Robert? How about applause? Yes. Thank you. So I mentioned I have a wife. I'm wearing a wedding ring. And my wife and I, we just passed a two-year anniversary. And we, for about the past year, we have been seeing an infertility doctor because she wants kids because she is a woman. And that's what you women do, is you think that's a good idea. Men don't want kids because we like, you know, playing video games and spare time, extra money, that kind of shit. But, right, and you know, in our household, she controls what we call the vagina, so I have to do what she wants. So we're trying to have kids, And as I said, we're seeing a fertility doctor because just going off birth control didn't do it for us. We went off birth control. She didn't get pregnant, so we decided, okay, we need to find out what's going on. Went to the fertility doctor, and he said, all right, first thing we do before we take drastic measures and drugs and that sort of, we just want to make sure you're having sex correctly. And I'm like, all right, I've seen some movies on the subject, quasi-documentaries. They finish in different places. I know that the one you have to fit, but either way, what he told us, he said, what I want to do is make sure that when your wife is ovulating, when she's in her cycle, when she can be pregnant, that you get as many guys up inside her. I want you to have sex 3 times a day, 3 days in a row, just to make sure you pack as many swimmers up there. And I said, cool, that's great advice, Doc. I like that, have that much sex. But then, for no reason, he kept talking. He said, because did you know that sperm can live in the female body for up to 3 days? Yeah, I'm like, ew. That, he just blocked me with his diagnosis, with his prescription of sex. I mean, I don't want to think about that. He told us to have sex 3 times a day. That means on the 3rd time, my wife and I are bumping uglies. My batch jumps out and is like, yay, let's get the egg. And they get in there, and right in front of them are the first 2 batches going, what's up? That's... Nobody wants that. But think about it. Then I started like getting in my head and thinking and worrying about this whole pregnancy thing. Have sex 3 times a day, 3 days in a row? Well, at first I'm like, yeah, a lot of sex is fun, but how much baby batter does he think my boys can make? I mean, that's a lot of sex. At some point, the well run dry. These are testicles between my legs. This is not a Chinese shoe factory down here. I can't just take one of them outside, make an example out of it, and scare the other into increasing production. That's not how it works. I mean, I don't do impersonations, but I will now let you know what the 3rd day, 3rd time orgasm sounded like. We would do that 3 times. This is what my final orgasm sounded like. Ready? That's it. That's what I'm trying to... There was nothing left. What I'm trying to tell you is a tumbleweed would come out of me, roll across the bedroom floor, and then I started wondering, okay, wait a second. If I don't get my wife pregnant on the 1st day, 1st time we make love, when all my swimmers are like Michael Phelps strong and Pitbull aggressive, boom, yeah, get the egg, fallopian tube. What am I shooting on the 3rd day, 3rd time? When you increase production like that, you know, shit gets sloppy. You know, there's no quality control. Yeah, those aren't the best and the brightest anymore. Those are the guys that were at the back of the line coming out late. They're swimming sideways and drooling and, you know, Timmy! You know, that's... Yeah. It's not going to fertilize an egg. It'll get to it, but then it'll just like... bounce off it. So that was step one, and having all the sex didn't work. So step two of seeing the fertility doctor was turkey baster. Wanted to make sure that my spermies ended up right next to her egg, so we put them right in there, and I got to push the plunger myself, which was kind of neat. I'm like... That way, if it had worked, I could at least say, oh, I was there when you were made, you know, to the little baby, but I had a hand in it. Hey, even that, I never even thought of it. Thumb. That didn't work. So what they wanted to do at the hospital is see whether my spermies or her eggs were misfiring. And to check me out, my wife got embarrassed. She was a little hesitant. She said, you have to go leave a sample. Are you okay with that? I'm like, am I okay with that? I'm a guy. I got excited. I had to go masturbate in the hospital. And she thought I'd be embarrassed to be, you know, in a different place. I'm like, you don't understand men, sweetie. You know how dogs pee on shit so they can own it? Same thing. Yeah. in that moment, I am owning, like, guys do that. Like, two guys at that table, he's probably jerked off in your bedroom or a bathroom when, you know, something like that. Like, oh, I've got to use the bathroom. I'll be back in 5 minutes. Yeah, use your towel tomorrow, motherfucker. We basically own that moment. It's the, you know, that's our ego at work. And it was kind of, this was sort of amusing. When I got there, they gave me a cup and said, go in this room and you'll have all the time you need, all the privacy, and we have pornography for you. I'm like, that's cool. I like pornography. So I pressed play on the DVD player. What they didn't tell me is it was female pornography. Yeah. Oh, do you know what I mean? I mean, like, it was written by a woman, directed by a woman, for women to purchase for their own personal needs. I mean, I pressed play, and it opened with 10 minutes of a candlelit dinner. He's laughing, yes. Then the guy started giving a massage, and then they started kissing. That's not male pornography. Male pornography is right to the point. Ding dong, pizza's here, you're wearing a bathrobe. Bounce, go, wow, wow. You know it. Yeah. Yeah. It gets right to there. There's no backstory. It just starts. That's. And I do understand the difference in pornography, and I understand there is a need for it, male and female pornography, because pornography plays to fantasy. That's why people look at it. It plays to fantasy. And men like to fantasize that they are powerful and virile and can have any woman at any time. Ding dong, you want me. Yeah, get down. I'm the plumber. Whatever. Yeah. And women like to watch candlelit dinners and massages and kissing because women like to fantasize that men actually care about them. My wife hates that joke. She said, you can't do that. The audience won't like you. I'm like, half the audience won't. So that was round two, and we're at round three, which is in vitro fertilization. Turned out my swimmers were fine. Her eggs were scrambled. I don't. So what they had to do is they had to go get an egg out of her and take my knuckle babies. They mix them together in a Petri dish and then put it back in her. And then that's what Robert was talking about. The Mississippi rule would have said, oh, can't do that because whatever. But either way, I didn't know this until we got the bill. We have good insurance, and thank God for that, because $12,000 for round one. And we only paid a little chunk of that. But I looked at that. I'm like, $12,000. For basically, you're spending a lot of money to create something that costs a lot of money. That doesn't compute to me. I mean, the only good thing that can come out of this is if we do have a baby, when it turns 18 and says, I want to go to college, I get to say, F you. We spent your tuition money making you, little shit. That would be. I got to be in the room for that also when she was inseminated with our cellular orgasm and organism, either way, sorry. I came out wrong, organism. And that was kind of neat because they put her in a table and then they put her in the stirrups and I'm like, hey, we could use this at home. But then, and I have finally learned this, for the longest time I stuttered. I would say, then they got, and I would forget and say, spatula, but it's not a spatula. I've just seen the movie Stripes too many times, you know, like, Aunt Jemima treatment, Aunt Jemima treatment. But it's a speculum, am I right? Did I say it? Yes, it's a speculum. And men in the audience right now looking at me, I tell you this, if you ever want to have your ego deflated and feel bad about yourself, watch the speculum at work. What they do, the speculum, they take it and they put it in my wife's honey pot, and then it goes. And I'm looking at her and going, hey, I didn't know it did that. Have I ever pleasured you? Is that? You're a really good actress, aren't you? Yeah, that makes the hot dog down a hallway thing look more like a needle in the Lincoln Tunnel. I'm not a large man. But that failed, and now December 9th, we get to go back and spend more money. Said I'm a Scorpio. That means this is my birth month, and it was yesterday. I turned 40 goddamn two. I am in my middle. Sure. You're more excited about it than I was. Once I cracked 40, I figure it's all downhill. How old are you, my friend? 53, so I got like a decade, and then all that happens to me, huh? Is that about... See? This is why I'm not excited by it. Yeah. See, that's part of the... The older I get, I know I'm going to be a great old man. I'm looking forward to that, where I wear like a bathrobe to the grocery store and push my cart yelling at people, "Get off my lawn!" Because that's what you do. I can't wait. But I think part of the reason I'm sort of anti-kid up here, you can get that sentiment that my wife wants him and I don't, is because I think, I don't know that I want my kid to grow up in today's society, because I think we're raising kids to be softer and weaker than we were raised. Do you agree with that? You think we're raising kids to be like 60? All right, the rest of you, I'll convince you. I think we're raising kids to be soft, because I remember my childhood. I played on playgrounds that were paved over, made out of concrete, blacktop, or some other hard surface. Who played on a concrete playground when they were growing up? Couple more of you. Yeah. Concrete playground, when you fell down, you got hurt, but you learned caution and respect. You learned about the world around you. One day I was 6 years old, went to a concrete playground, got on the swings. I started going back and forth and back and forth. What did I do when I got to the top? Jumped, exactly. And as soon as I got in the air, I went, "That was a bad f***ing idea." Yeah. Because I saw the concrete. I knew I was going to hit it. I landed. I hurt myself. I limped home crying. But back then, parenting meant my dad took one look at me and started laughing. "What'd you learn?" That's what my dad asked. I was a child crying. I wanted a hug. I wanted to feel better. My dad was laughing and asking, "What'd you learn?" I didn't know what he meant. I thought about it. I said, "Well, I'm learning you're a dick. How about that?" But, I know I'm not going to jump off the swings again. Pain taught me a lesson. But somewhere in the past 15 to 20 years, a kid fell down on a playground, ran home crying. The parent didn't ask, "What'd you learn?" The parent went, "Oh, my sweet little angel, you hurt yourself. Well, it's not your fault, Snookums. It's not my fault. Heaven forbid parental responsibility. I'm gonna sue. I'm gonna sue the city, the county, the state. I'm gonna make them make playgrounds out of Nerf. That way when kids fall down, they bounce back. Just like bumbles bounce. In fact, I am going to sue and make them pass legislation that says whenever a child goes out to play, that child has to be protected. If he wants to go on the swings, he has to wear knee pads. If he wants to go down a slide, he has to wear elbow pads. And if he wants to ride a bike, he has to wear a helmet. Well, we're going to get kids all f***ed up." Yeah. Until they look like mini American gladiators in puffy suits and they just bounce off one another and walk like... And that kid didn't learn a lesson. And now we're raising a generation of Nancy Pantses because of it. Yeah, because the playground used to teach you caution and respect. You find anyone older than 25 that walks with a limp or has a scar running down their leg, ask them about it. Ask them, say, "Hey, buddy, I noticed you got a little hitch in your giddy up there. What happened? A car accident?" Or he'll look back at you like, "Car accident? No, that merry-go-round." "Yeah, it got to spinning and I fell off, but I didn't fall all the way off. No, it hooked me. It hooked and spun me and dragged me through the gravel because that's where they used to situate the spinning wheel of death, remember? The gravel. Yeah. So they would find a soft patch of land, lay down a bed of rocks, and right in the center it went. But go to a playground today, 2011, merry-go-round, boom, gone, because it wasn't safe. Oh, no, the children. Yeah. And they've changed the teeter-totter. Yeah, the seesaw, the teeter-totter, the old one, that wasn't safe either. Oh, no, the children. So the new one, today's teeter-totter, is a spring-loaded board. It can only wobble a couple inches on either side, and two kids sit on it and bounce. Boingy, 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 wee, boingy, 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 yay, boingy. Oh, hell no! The teeter-totter used to go up and down and up again, and when you were on top, your friend would look at you, smile a wicked smile, yell, cherry bomb, jump off. You fell to the ground and banged your ass, and it hurt. But you learned not to trust people. Yeah. That is an important lesson to learn in life, not to trust your fellow man. That is probably the most important lesson a child can learn. And if we raise a generation that doesn't understand that, they will find out the hard way human interaction involving approachability or accountability. They won't know until it's too late that if you pick up a hitchhiker, you end up in the trunk of your own car. Or if you're 15 and experimenting and play a round of, oh, just the tip, you still end up pregnant. I mean, that's... It's a fun game right there. All right, thank you so much. Have a good night.
Thanks to Nathan Timmel for visiting with us on The Live Feed. More information on Nathan can be found at www.nathantimmel.com. Another big thank you goes out to Lindsay Hensel and to Mark Lytle, founders of the Big Boobs Comedy Show. You've been listening to The Live Feed.
Thanks for listening to The Live Feed. The Live Feed is produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. For more information on tonight's show, visit us at kqal.org.